I thought it would be good to start out with a undeniable fact. I don't know if there'll be any others. The undeniable fact is I'm not an economist. But after Dr. Lowe's talk, I thought maybe I would go back to school a little while. The one thing I won't do in his classroom if I do that is give a talk right after he gives one. I'm going to read a sentence here, which I wrote a long time ago, third of a century ago, to kind of show you where I stand on certain issues. The challenge of Darwinism, this was in my book, Darwinism and Human Affairs, the challenge of Darwinism is to find out what our genes have been up to and to make that knowledge widely available as a part of the environment in which each of us develops and lives so that we can decide for ourselves quite deliberately to what extent we wish to go along. I think it's important to know where people stand on issues like that right from scratch. My talk is going to have three sections: an introduction about evolution, a short discussion in the middle about football, and the final part will be, you all have a handout, right? Two handouts? A one-page handout, that's the one that'll be in the third section. And then there's a three-page handout, and that one is just for you to take home to do whatever, because it's a set, it carries in it references to a lot of the recent evolutionary work on humans and on other organisms that apply to things that apply to humans. Brett, could I borrow you for a second? So I will start with my little introduction to evolution. Human society is a phrase we use to refer to virtually everything about modern humans, presumably living in a civilized manner. But everyone knows that, in fact, we're a frighteningly long way from putting our global human house in order. Leaving aside all other problems, in January 2006, the National Geographic magazine reported that 50 million people were deliberately killed during the 20th century in 48 instances of mass murders. That's their word. 50 million people means averages of 500,000 a year, 14,000 a day, close to that. Not surprisingly, they labeled the 20th century the killing century. Other investigators have provided detailed figures indicating at least three times as many deaths from wars and genocides in the 20th century. For example, an anthropologist named Scaruffi in 2006 estimated 160 million deaths, deliberate deaths, in the 20th century. After a long period of insisting that, unlike modern humans, our ancestors were appropriately characterized as peaceful and gentle nomads, anthropologists have begun to accept that rates of killing are almost certainly higher in earlier pre-technological societies than they are today, with something like 20-30% of the men dying at the hands of others in their own species. Nevertheless, the number of deliberate killings in wars and genocides since the American Civil War may be larger than the number of humans that existed prior to what Jared Diamond called the Great Leap Forward about 50,000 years ago. We have to add that no one has yet found a way to measure satisfactorily the pain, misery, and suffering that results from such mass killings, the effects of permanent physical maiming, disablement, the extent and expense of mental and emotional distress from deliberate wholesale destruction of fellow human beings. Current wars may not be typical of prehistorical conflicts in this regard, but reports of their effects almost every day suggest that the numbers of people damaged significantly by war is many times higher than the numbers killed. We're just starting another century. Doesn't look as though we're going to do any better. I wonder how many people have seriously asked themselves at length why humans persistently do terrible things of this sort. Given our huge brains, our cognitive abilities, our capacity for fellowship, sympathy and empathy, our ability to be consciously thoughtful, and our confidence that deep down we're all basically kind and generous, how can we accept or tolerate such killings on such scales? How can we fail to spend much of our thinking time finding ways to prevent such horrific and extreme events? 150 million people in one century. Even if we took it in the middle and said 100 million, it's a million people a year on average. Is there anything more important than that? Maybe there is, but I don't know what it is. Why should it be true that the numbers, if not the rates, of people dying in mass murders seem to increase rather than diminishing dramatically as what we call civilization continues to develop and using the politician's term, move forward? We rationalize, perhaps, that people not known to us personally or people who seem competitive with us are in fact not so important. Or are such explanations little more than indicators because we're satisfied to invoke them without worrying about seeking better answers? Is it that we humans are in some ways the most bizarre and outrageous of all forms of life, if for no other reason than that we alone understand the opposites of labels like bizarre and outrageous and still behave as we do? Is it that we alone among all species have been designed by our evolutionary history to accept and promote intergroup competition within our own species? Do we continue in this design not in spite of our tendencies to show enormous affection, cooperativeness, patriotism, loyalty to kin and friends within our own social groups and moral systems at the level of nations and alliances of nations, but utilizing those cooperative and seemingly benevolent tendencies, the extremes of which may actually have evolved, perhaps, as vehicles of intergroup competition? We seem to overcome distressing experiences and thoughts of this sort by more or less deliberately returning our minds and our activities to peaceful and tranquil preoccupations, such as the harmony of our families and our local communities, situations in which things are typically much gentler. We're not so close to the competition that gets involved. We have people and places where we live and work that are friendly and where the local moral rules are so well understood and so nearly universal that we can feel confident and secure. But do the extremes of these seeming respites actually prime us, set us up for the next competitive or violent go-round? Are we hyper-patriotic as a result of all that camaraderie? Why are such temporary reliefs the seeming antidote to carrying on a wide or global scale? How did we become so effective at putting such things out of our minds so quickly and so inadequate about finding ways to prevent these things? Can it be a heritage from our having become so dominant ecologically as a species that we could afford to turn our attention to others among our own species as a new and lasting principal hostile force of nature? Darwin described the hostile forces of nature, the forces of selection, as predators, parasites, diseases, food shortages, climate, and weather, and that's it, except for sexual selection, and nowadays people talk about social selection. But in this case, it looks as though, and I'm not the first one to say this at all, it looks as though we have become the only species in which its principal hostile force of nature is groups of our own species. Seems to me we might want to know a great deal more about how we got to be the way we are and how we might be able to stop that constant flow of such grotesque happenings. The unique human tendency to engage in intergroup competitions and conflicts within our own species could not have become paramount until humans had become able to transfer investment in calories and risk takings in within species competitions more than is apparently the case in any others of the tens of millions of living species. Competition and conflict between groups and within species is responsible for the amity-enmity, the we-they axis that virtually defines human society. The intensity of cooperativeness and loyalty that typically exist within close-knit groups and enables them to be successful in competitions. Nowadays, apparently for the first time in history, we are acknowledging that we have generated global problems involving at least war, overpopulation, environmental pollution, human-induced climatic warming, and resource depletion. These global problems can only be solved in ways that will be at least temporarily and also variably expensive to everyone, even though in the end far less expensive if we do not confront and solve them. The question is, can humans cooperate successfully on a global scale, particularly when different groups retain the tendency to compete, when everyone is likely to suffer temporary and sometimes unpredictable expense in acts of cooperation, and when everyone has the probability of realizing consciously that the effort might be more costly for them than for some others, likely to be seen as competitors. There seems to be no evidence that humans have ever before behaved like a single global cooperative population on such a project. I would like to believe that one of the good ways, a useful way to change ourselves in ways that have a chance at least of reducing the slaughter that has characterized our species and to begin to solve other growing global problems is to understand on a wide scale, in detail, accurately, at long last, the evolutionary process that has constructed us, how it has affected us as whole functioning individuals and groups, and why it seems to have prohibited us from the most important features of our species and of our ourselves as individuals. We seem to have two possible strategies at least. One, use the components of our evolved within-group cooperativeness to diminish rather than enhance destructive between-group competition. And two, work consciously to go directly against evolved tendencies that lead to global and other dire problems. What are we talking about when we speak of life as a whole? Life probably includes 50 million species of animals and plants. Any one of those species may have uncountable numbers of individuals. Every individual may be made up of trillions of cells. I've heard the figure of 60 trillion for humans, but I don't know if it's correct. Those trillions of cells are organized in dozens, maybe hundreds of different kinds of complex tissues and organs. Every one of those trillions of cells has within it the entire complement of genes and is referred to as the genome. Every one of those 50 million species is unique in sexual forms, and so is every one of those uncountable numbers of living individuals. Despite that oh my description, evolution itself is a very simple process involving stable but occasionally mutating DNA molecules and the differential reproduction of those molecules. All natural selection can do is cause genes and some learning to persist across generations. The puzzle behind the diversity and complexity of the consequences of evolution is the almost unimaginable myriads, is probably the right word, of different environments. The process is simple until you factor in the environments generated in hierarchies and combinations and sequences by the presence and diversifying effects of life and of evolving forms of life. These environments are appropriately described by adjectives like intrinsic and extrinsic, macro and micro, novel and repetitive, stable and unstable, and so on. Genes in sexual organisms, for example, one small example, genes in sexual organisms have to get along in all the different environments into which they are placed as a result of sexual reproduction, because every genome is unique. So every genomic environment is unique to the gene. That's a big complication. It's a second source of puzzlement that individual genes in their multitudes of environments have surely always been evolving in the direction of increased cooperation. I would say evolving toward complete cooperation in each of the genomes in which they arrive and persist temporarily during the period of the organism's reproduction. This statement is correct even if the genes in a genome never achieve complete cooperation. It's also true even if this cooperation is what Theodosius Dobzhansky once said, development is unitary. Even if development is unitary, this is true. Genes are able to shift from one genome so infrequently that biologists write enthusiastically about it whenever they do, and sometimes they receive awards like Nobel Prizes for discovering or explaining it. The success of individual genes persisting across successive generations depends almost entirely on the success of the genome as a whole. If you can't change genomes, if you're a gene in a genome and you can't change, the only way you can improve things, the only way you can change to a different gene, for example, that is better, is if you do something that enhances the success of the genome as a whole. Now, let me, after that fractured little discussion of evolution, let me go to the second part of my talk. My watch left. Is that all right? Okay. I have a little exercise I do with students and sometimes other audiences. Somehow I look at you guys and I think you're a little too sophisticated for this little exercise, and you might say, yuck. But I like to go through it. It's a parallel to what I just said in some part. And it's about football. And I usually begin it by asking the students, do you think football is important? A kind of a vague question, but I tell them that's the way I want it to be, vague. And they frown and are puzzled. Then I ask them how many of them have never attended a football game, watched a football game, listened to a football game on the radio? Nobody ever raises a hand. So then I go to the fact that there are about some 4,000 or 5,000 faculty members at the University of Michigan on the campus, and I ask them, who among them do they think has the highest income? Then they start getting somewhere and they say, somebody says, usually, the football coach. So we go from there to who brings in the biggest crowds in the whole University of Michigan. Yeah, the football team. The football team pays for all the other sports. How much does it cost to attend a football game at the University of Michigan? Do you know? Just out of curiosity. I didn't know. Somebody said $50, and the others nodded. $50? What events bring in the most money? Are you aware that the stadium is being added to the tune of $178 million? Did you know that the university has separated the money that comes into the university into that which goes to sports and that which goes to academic affairs, and the guys who get the sports money spend it on sports? And that's the way it is. In any case, we get around to the idea that football does have some kind of importance. And I say then, well, what is football anyway? What is it? It's called a game and it's said to be played. What do those words mean? What does it mean to play? And I end up telling them what biologists usually describe as play. They usually say it's practice in low-cost situations for performance in full-cost situations, the real world. Somebody often says that. Then I say this, which is true. I thought of it in 1987 when I was writing something in a book, and it occurred to me that humans are the only organism that plays competitively, group against group. Plays competitively, group against group. And I put it in the book and sort of held my breath, wondering who would say Alexander is wrong and come up with some species. But it didn't happen. Donald Simons at Santa Barbara, who is an anthropologist that did his doctoral thesis on play in rhesus monkeys, wrote in his next book, Alexander is Right. And I breathed a big sigh of relief. I wonder if people think that people who engage in sports, and the audiences too, are actually practicing for some kind of full-cost performance. And then I ask, what do you think the full-cost performance that they're practicing for is? And I said, the last time I gave this talk, which was yesterday, I said, I have a three-letter word for it. And some people said war. And I agreed with them. Now, the reason I do that about football is because football is something we know a lot about. We we've grown up with football. We all know about football. But how many of you thought about the parts that I ended up with? How many of you, in the same vein as my statements about intergroup competition, how many of you got the idea about what evolution has done there and what evolution is doing here with sports like football and so forth? And I'm trying to say that we go through life knowing virtually nothing about something that Dr. Lowe spoke about, and that is that everything we do, every trait, every tendency is dependent on evolution. You can't make a separation. It doesn't seem possible to us. But if you think about it and think about it and think about it, I think you'll have no alternative but to agree eventually, because there is nothing else. There's only the evolutionary process. There's no other process. There's nothing else to give us the traits that we have and the trait expressions that we have. You might say, oh yeah, but what about learning? Well, a long time ago, I wrote a sentence about learning like the one I read to you at the start, in which I said that if the capacity for learning does not cause the learning to come out increasing the reproduction of the organisms that are doing the learning, then the capacity for learning cannot continue, will not continue. Natural selection will either wipe it out, trim it down, or change its direction. I don't see any alternative to that. So you can't get around it just by thinking about learning. And it's really quite a proposition to try to get around that business of natural selection being involved in everything we do. Will you turn to that single page at the end now, please? It's called Table 1, and it's comparing apes and humans in an effort to explain how humans evolved their traits. I liked handouts because they can go home with you, and some of these, I think, might be useful to some of you. Notice that I have four groups of five groups of apes, and then humans over on the right side. And then I have a list of traits here down through 1 through 17 on the right side. And I'm going to talk about some of those and how they perhaps got the way they are now. First, we'll just talk about those different apes. Remember, these are not ancestors of humans. People would call them distant cousins. But if you look at those numbers, 22, 16, 8, 6, right below gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, and chimps. Those are the millions of years that humans finally got on a separate line after that particular kind of ape lived. Gibbons, in other words, branched off from the line that later would give rise to humans 22 million years before that happened, and 16 for orangutans. And yet they have very similar sets of DNA molecules. So something else is going to be discovered and worked out eventually. Gibbons are territorial in pairs. They're monogamous, often for life. There are 9 species of gibbons. There's only 1 orangutan, 1 gorilla, 1 chimp, 1 bonobo, and then humans. Orangutans are one male with a dispersed group of females, so the male kind of goes around through the forest and finds the females. Gorillas have a similar kind of breeding system, except that the harem of females stays with the male. You've all seen pictures of that. It's not surprising that orangutans and gorillas have males that are very much larger than the females. It's not surprising that gibbons are almost the same size, except the males are like humans, a little larger than the females. Chimps and bonobos have a little more sexual dimorphism than gibbons or humans, and they live in, interestingly enough, they're the interesting ones, really. They live in groups that have multiple females and multiple males, and their breeding system is a promiscuous polygyny, very promiscuous polygyny. They live in parties, and I'll come back to these two species because they're very interesting. How many of you read about bonobos or seen them? I don't know how many people know about them. They're only species that's sort of been discovered a few years ago. Humans live in multiple male and female groups and often form large kin groups. During the times that a lot of anthropologists were doing work in the 19th century, they found that humans lived in kin groups of 200, 300, 250, around in there, multiple males, multiple females, and everyone related. The in-laws are related too, in a sense, because they're going to be participating in the stream of reproduced babies and so forth. So it's everybody is kin. It's a very interesting situation. It puts the individuals in a position to fulfill, for the first time, William D. Hamilton's statement that we predict that organisms will evolve to treat, that social organisms will evolve to treat their other organisms in their species according to their degree of relatedness, according to their genetic overlap. I'm going to come back to that, but I don't want to talk more about it right at this minute. Now, I say that chimps and bonobos live in small groups, and they do. But they do a very funny thing. How many of you know the word corroboree, just out of curiosity? Corroboree. Nobody knows the word. Wow. Thank you. Corroborees are get-togethers, fantastic get-togethers that take place among Australian Aboriginals at certain times. Many different groups come together, and there'll be hundreds of Aboriginals, and they're all celebrating and having a big ceremony and so forth. And a lot of mating goes on, and probably a lot of outbreeding. It turns out that chimps and bonobos have these, I call them corroborees also, bonobos in particular. And I don't know more about them than that, so I'll just leave it right there. Bonobos are not well known. These kinds of things are not well known about chimps either. So we just hold that for a while. And when I say a while, I mean a year or two or maybe five before we find out anything more. So the question here, one question that's already facing us is, how come humans can live in these groups of 200 and 300? One thing is they all know who their relatives are, and they know how to stack them up in terms of relatedness. They may not know the names for all of them, or they may have names that puzzle us, but they know that an aunt is a closer relative than a cousin. And they know that a first cousin is a closer relative than a first cousin once removed. Indeed, they separated cousins into four parts, four kinds: matrilateral parallel, matrilateral cross cousins, patrilateral parallel, and patrilateral cross cousins. They did this in connection with having marriage rules which allowed them to either mate with a patrilateral cross cousin or a matrilateral cross cousin, but never with parallel cousins. Parallel cousins are the offspring of siblings of the same sex, each one with their own mating partner. Cross cousins are cousins where the parents are different sexes. And the whole thing is an inbreeding outbreeding. That particular thing is an inbreeding outbreeding phenomenon. I'm telling you this kind of detail to emphasize that they knew the stuff that would cause them to turn up with a match with Bill Hamilton's statement that I just spoke a minute ago. So something very complex is going on with regard to the large kin groups of humans. There's no way chimps or bonobos can ever do that. Do you know why? I mean, can you see why on here? I can tell you what the enabler is. Number four is called concealed ovulation. Ovulation is concealed. You know what ovulation is? That's when babies can be produced, when the egg is ready to be fertilized. How do human females conceal ovulation? They just don't show very much of anything that would tell anybody when they're ovulating. Sometimes with modern gadgets, we can, like thermometers, and with knowledge of ovulation, they can work out, women can work out when they ovulate. But there's no evidence that any pre-industrial people ever even knew that ovulation existed. It wasn't a concept that they had. And so when they concealed ovulation, here's what happened. They could establish a breeding system in which both male relatives and female relatives could be kept track, could keep track, because the males would separate off with the females, form pair bonds, and because the females weren't revealing ovulation, love them and leave them males couldn't come along, mate with female, leave, and leave the female or the female and her male to take care of his kid. That wouldn't work. Now, chimps and bonobos are both promiscuous, extremely promiscuous. The females, all of you have surely seen pictures of females, female chimps, maybe not bonobos, but female chimps with the huge swellings of flesh that are like that size. It caused Jane Lancaster to say that, I'm sorry, Jane Goodall to say that whenever she saw a female chimp that was ovulating, she was very glad she was not a chimpanzee. So what happens? Multiple males mate with the females. So who's the father? Nobody knows who the fathers are in a chimp band or in a bonobo band. That side of the kinship system, the possibility of an organized kinship system like the one humans have, doesn't exist. There's a half a kinship system, the female side, but the male side just kind of goes off like a will-o'-the-wisp and disappears because nobody knows who the male father is, who the father is. So concealed ovulation becomes extremely important in the organization of the social organization of humans. There are a lot of ways to conceal ovulation, by the way, and I don't want to confuse you. For example, female horses have three ways of concealing ovulation. I won't spend time going into it, but they're different from this. One way is to ovulate, show estrus or receptivity for a very long period when the ovulation is going to be a very narrow time in the middle of that or somewhere in that, and the male horse doesn't know. If a female horse tries to join a group, a male and his harem, so to speak, she doesn't get in, usually, without allowing the male to copulate with her. So she, in a sense, pretends to be in estrus. And she is in estrus in the sense of receptivity. So the male mates with her, and he keeps on mating with her, and she stays in estrus, stays receptive, until she actually ovulates, even if it takes 2 weeks. That's a way of concealing ovulation. Another way, well, there are other ways. Anyway, we're talking about people. Now, I have, I want to ask one more thing. Turn down here to number 9. Look at the so-called average maximum lifetime. That's what 40 to 45 is for the apes. All of them the same. That suggests that that length of a lifetime is very stable. Because look, one of them branched off 22 million years ago, one 16 million years ago, one 8 million years ago, and two of them branched off 3 million years after their ancestor branched off from humans. So that's a lot of time, and during all that time, they come up with essentially the same lifetimes. That's something pretty stable. Now look at humans over there on the right side by number 9. 80 to 90 year lifetime, we doubled it. Now don't get confused. This is not average lifetime. This is average maximum lifetime. I don't know exactly how the population biologists figure it, but I can tell you roughly how it works. If you have a population of 2 and one lives to be 80 and the other one dies at birth, the average lifetime is 40. The maximum lifetime is 80. The average maximum in this 2 animal population is also 80. Now, if you stick somebody in there who's got a 70-year lifetime, you're going to have a 75 average up there near the top, and you can call that the average maximum lifetime. And you can see that the average lifetime then will be in that population, suppose there are 2 newborns too, comes down to what, 35 or something like that. Incidentally, if you think these things change swiftly, I will tell you that the only medical researcher I know who has seriously worked on the question of whether or not, or how much, he started out to answer, how much medical medical work has increased the average maximum lifetime since the medical profession began? You know what the answer is? Nothing. No statistical change in the average maximum life length since the beginning of the medical practice. That paper was published in 1980. I don't know what's happened since then. I have 5 minutes. Wow. How can you double your lifetime? The only way you can double your lifetime that I know is to increase the rate of reproduction during adulthood. If you can do that, then the genes that are bringing off the additional reproduction will save the lifetime, increase the lifetime, because they persist longer as a result. Most of the time, organisms reproduce terrifically early in life, and then it falls off quickly. We know that a lot of animals only and plants reproduce only once. Soybeans, if you watch a soybean field, it goes all brown on the same day, the whole field, because they only fix their seeds once and then they're done. If you watch salmon in streams, there's beautiful big females, lay all their eggs, and if they have a gene that causes them to die 1 second after they lay the last egg, they're dead, because there is no reproduction left for them, for the genes to operate on, so to speak. That gene that causes that salmon to die after it lays its last egg doesn't have any effect on life length or anything else, except it kills the female. So you and I are the descendants of people who evolved to increase their reproduction during their adult lifetimes. And you're going to look up there and see the word menopause by number 5 and say, wait a minute, doesn't menopause mean, it used to be said all the time that menopause was the end of reproduction for women. It's a post-reproductive period, not post-reproductive period. Whenever people talk about evolution only changing reproduction, they're not talking about having babies, just having babies. Yes, having babies is reproduction. But the other form of reproduction is tending relatives, including offspring for that matter, but tending any relatives. So what if menopause is a way of turning off baby production because older women become more political, they become more capable of serving the kin, they may become capable of serving the whole kin group. Males do too, but they don't go through a menopause, so people don't pay as much attention to them. This happens in humans, and that's the reason that this is the only species that poor Bill Hamilton's theory applies to on a wide scale. So those two things, concealment of ovulation and the increased lifetime in menopause, those things all fit together, and they explain something. They explain how we can form a great big group of nepotistic individuals and generate those moral systems that we know exist in groups like that, moral systems that people are usually capable of turning into absolute authority, absolute morality, and so forth. And if you are surrounded by other groups that are hostile to you, then you have the situation that I started this talk with. Now, let me take one more here. Altricial offspring, number 10. Altricial means helpless, if I just shorten it, helpless. You know, if you have had a baby or if you have a sibling that was a baby, what I mean. When I picked up our first baby and she was a day or two old, I looked at her and said to my wife, my gosh, she's like a maggot with legs and arms. How are we going to keep this thing alive? That's what I said. We managed. But everybody says, well, how did this happen? And there are a million theories. They're all junk. They are theories like, well, they don't have as long a gestation period as the apes. Yes, they do. They're the same. They said, well, if they stayed in the genital tract any longer, they would rupture the tract when they came out. No, they wouldn't, because they could evolve to be any size and helpless, or any size and hairy. That's not the point. What is the point? We have altricial songbirds. They're naked. They can't do much. We have altricial mice and other rodents, and they can't do much. Altricial humans can't either. What are they doing? They're turning all their calories into something else other than having to take care of themselves. A baby chimpanzee can hang on to its mother when she's running full speed and so forth. A baby horse can get up and run in 20 minutes, and so forth. They're not altricial, they're precocial. But altricial offspring are doing something that enables them to gain so much that the parents gain too. And you can guess at what the baby is doing. You know what is the hard thing to get out of a mother when she's birthing a baby? The head. That's not an accident. It's not an accident that what is difficult to get out with a horse is legs, because it can run in 20 minutes right alongside its mother at a very good clip. It's not an accident that others have shoulder problems and so forth. Well, the head. Now look what it says here. Extended juvenile period. Songbirds come out sooner when they're altricial. But the juvenile human takes longer, a lot longer. All older parents, will know, along with me, that in humans, when you're a parent, you're always a parent. Huge complex brain, we've got it. And extensive language and extensive imagination and self-recognition, and all those things go with it. So two parents go with it too, biparental care. I usually change it to parental bonding and biparental care. That's what I usually call it, because I think that's what it ought to be called. So we have large bilateral kin groups, we have altricial offspring, we have very complex kin organizations, and it's a terrific fighting group, if you want to think that way. Can't go any longer. I can't tell you anything about nudity and bipedalism, and that's pretty funny in a way, because those are the things that everybody always talked about. They added language, but they talked a lot about nudity and bipedalism and tried to figure out ways to explain it, and I don't know that anybody has explained it. People say, well, we got bipedal because it was good for carrying things, to have free hands. Maybe. I don't know for sure. Nudity? The best argument that I heard, and not the best, the worst I ever heard, was the comparative physiologist who said, it's good because when they are chasing prey in the desert, they can sweat better when they don't have hair. Problem is, the man who does most of the chasing of predators has the most hair. Who has the least? The baby. The women are in between. I suspect that nudity has to do with sexual selection, and that nudity gets tied to youthfulness, and that's how it works, but I don't know. Anyway, these are subjects that are very important if we want to understand ourselves, and some of them are understood and some of them are not. And I better quit or I'm going to get attacked.